prior to the prayer that Pat Hunt is home now from the hospital and doing well after her surgery on her hip. Okay, we have been looking at the Epistle of James, and as we have noted, James just deals with various topics and just goes from one topic to another, jumps from one to another. He began talking about considering it joyful when we are in times of trial. He then talked about wisdom and asking God for wisdom. And now he talks about the idea of your attitude toward material wealth, toward material things. And so I want us to look at these verses here, verses 9 through 11. He says, "But the brother of humble circumstances is to glory in his high position, and the rich man is to glory in his humiliation, because like flowering grass, he will pass away. For the sun rises with a scorching wind and withers the grass, and its flower falls off, and the beauty of its appearance is destroyed. So too the rich man in the midst of his pursuits will fade away." As you go through the book of James, there are quite a few things that James has to say about a person's attitude toward wealth, and about wealthy people. And here he talks about two contrasting persons or two contrasting situations that a Christian brother might be in. Someone of humble circumstances, and I think he means that in this context, refer to someone who is not materially well off. That is in contrast to the rich man that he talks about in verse 10. And let me just, before we look at the particular things that James says to each of these individuals, let me ask you this question. The audience to whom James is writing this epistle, do you think that most of them are pretty well off financially? Would they be in the rich category? Would they be in the poor category? Would they be somewhere in the middle? Poor to middle? Okay. Really, it's interesting when, just based upon what we can tell about the economic dynamics of first century Palestine and the Jewish population in general, you do have some Jews, a minority of Jews, that were in the rich category. They kind of been benefited by various circumstances, maybe especially their connection or having connections with Rome. But, of course, Rome has dominated Palestine, and Palestine is this client kingdom as part of the Roman Empire. There were a few Jews who were wealthy, but most Jews in general were certainly not wealthy, and they were the far other side of the spectrum. Now, you did have some who were landowners, and so you might think of them sort of as middle class. But you got a lot of Jews who are in poverty, relative poverty. Now, that's Jews in general. Think about this particular audience of Jews. As we've already said several times in our previous classes, you're talking about Jewish disciples, Jewish Christians. At this time, I would, as I've said, I think James is written early. And so at this time, basically, the Church of Jesus is comprised primarily, nearly entirely, of just Jews at this early stage. But what's been their circumstance, these Jews, to whom he's writing, right? I think Ralph's right on target. Couldn't have said it better myself. If we're correct in where we're placing this letter, and I think all the indications would indicate that we are, then you are talking about Jews who maybe even if, say, originally they had been more middle-class Jews, just the circumstances that they were in, I would think would have made a lot of them suddenly decline economically. And just the state that they were in, just because they had become followers of Jesus, and then, say, being ousted out of Jerusalem, and maybe they would, in their dispersion, maybe they would be able to go back to their previous places of living. But you can just imagine a lot of them, their whole lives would have been turned upside down. They're having to get reestablished in Jewish society. And I think what Ralph said is correct, that maybe not a complete kind of ostracization from Jewish society, not at this early stage, but there's at least some real tension there. I mean, how are non-Christian Jews viewing Christian Jews at this time? They're viewing them as Jews, but they're followers of this strange new sect, this sect of the Nazarenes, these people that follow this Jesus from Nazareth. And, it absolutely has been a group of people who have been persecuted. So people are going to look at them with disdain. You can just imagine in the marketplaces where they're trying to sell their goods, even their fellow countrymen, I don't want to deal with them. You just imagine all those sorts of things that would have affected them economically. And that may be part of the kind of trial that James had started out talking about back in verse 2. So my point in all this is that even though he sort of jumped to seemingly a totally unrelated topic, might not be totally unrelated to what he's been talking about before, the idea of the persecutions and all of that. Be that as it may, it's just real clear that throughout the book of James, he has a lot to say about wealthy people. And there's some very uncomplimentary things he says about wealthy people in chapter 5. Right now, what he's saying is, no matter what your status is, if you are a brother of humble circumstances, okay, glory in your high position. If you are a rich man, you need to glory in your humiliation. So let's talk about what he means by that. First of all, when he talks about this brother of humble circumstances, he needs to glory in his high position. What do you think he means by that? If I am a poor person, and even as a Jewish believer in Jesus, I've lost even a lot of my economic prosperity that I previously had, What kind of high position do I have to glory in, James? Hey, I'm a child of God. I'm a follower of our Messiah King. I am a citizen of God's heavenly kingdom. That's what every Jew have been looking forward to for centuries, that high position, that high status. So if you are in poverty in this world's goods, he's saying, well, you glory in your high position as a follower of our King, a follower of Jesus, the Messiah. But then what's he mean in verse 10 when he talks about the rich man? And the rich man is to glory in his humiliation, because like flowering grass, he will pass away. What's he mean by that? What's he mean by humiliation, Pat? Okay. And in light of what he goes on to say, what do you think he's especially focusing in on in regard to this humiliation that a rich man needs to, ultimately, he says, glory in? Yeah, Isaac.
Your wealth can do nothing to save you.
All right, your wealth can do nothing to save you. In fact, your wealth, ultimately, what's going to happen to it? It's not going to survive. Let's look at this whole line of thought here, verses 10 through 11. You kind of have to get the whole picture here. And the rich man is to glory in his humiliation, because like flowering grass, he will pass away. For the sun rises with a scorching wind and withers the grass, and its flower falls off, and the beauty of its appearance is destroyed. So too the rich man in the midst of his pursuits will fade away. Let me just comment to you. The imagery, first of all, that he's talking about, the idea of like flowering grass, and that's going to fade away when the sun rises and begins to scorch it. This is an image that I think really would have resonated with a Jewish population. The hills of Judea, and I had the privilege in about 1990 to actually go and go to Palestine and to see this. And when I was there, we were kind of lucky because the rainy season had kind of extended. And so the hills of Judea were still green. But once that season is over with, and you start getting into the summer months, I mean, that it just dies real quickly. And this is something... of course, it happens throughout the world, different parts of the world, but this is especially something that I think would have been really apparent. And as you're making your pilgrimage up to Jerusalem three times a year, as a good, faithful Jewish man would, and maybe the entire family, you know, you make your trek, and you just see, as the year goes on, just how the grass and the flowers of the field have just withered. And so this is the imagery that he's using. And he says a rich man's going to fade like that too. The rich man is going to pass away. He's not talking about the rich man dying per se, but his status as a rich man is going to die. His status as a rich man is going to fade away. Now that might be at the time of his own death. But the point is, just like the grass and the flowers of the field that seem for the moment to be just fertile and just great and beautiful and in their regalia and all of that, yet very quickly it's all gone. And he says it like this, and I think it's such an important lesson for us, because let me ask a similar question to what I asked you previously. The people here in this room, are we in the category of rich, middle class, or poor?
In comparison to the rest of the world, we're rich.
Okay. I mean, we talk in our society about, you know, economic classifications and all this. And, you know, we may say, oh, well, maybe most of us are middle class or something like that. Let me tell you why. In comparison with the world, everybody in this room is rich. Everybody in this room. There are just millions of people in this world that would love to be in the position economically that, say, the person in this room who maybe is in the least economic condition, the lowest economic condition, people in this world that would just do anything to be able to have that. And certainly in comparison with the original audience, people to whom James is writing. I tell you what, we're all rich. So this really should mean something to us, okay? And what he's saying is that our richness, it's going to pass away. There's no question about that. Everything we have, the wealthiest person in this room, you're going to lose it all. That's just a promise. It's not going to last. Whether it's in this life, and there's a downturn economically, and you know, or even at your own death, like the author of Ecclesiastes talks about so often, you're going to lose it all. So that's the point that he's making. A rich man is only rich temporarily. That's a fact. Nothing is going to change that. But why does he say, verse 10, the rich man is to glory in that humiliation? Why would he say that? Almost seems like he's saying the rich man is to glory in the fact that his material wealth is not going to last. It's going to fade away. Why would he glory in such a thing? Okay, because he knows. And he's lived his life and used his riches, his wealth, in such a way as to be obedient to the Lord. So he knows that this fading away position he's in right now is but a stepping stone to then a greater kind of glory. So the fact that this life and this world and the riches of this world are definitely going to fade away, good. Because the rich man who understands all this, he doesn't put his confidence in his riches. He doesn't want to be forever in this life. In fact, he's looking anxiously for the time when he can be with Jesus in that eternal kingdom, that time when all of this wealth would have passed away. Great. That's what he's looking forward to. That's a completely different way of viewing material wealth than anybody would ever think to view it. But that's what James is saying. So, whether you're poor or whether you're rich in this world's goods, you need to have a perspective on it that will be appropriate to that situation. If you are in poverty right now, well, glory in your high position as a follower of King Jesus and all that that means. You are royalty, and you're just awaiting the time when your royalty will be fully made known and revealed as a child of God. Or if you are a rich person in this world's goods, will you glory in the fact that one day all this is going to be gone and there's going to be a better world and a better kingdom that you're a part of? Just a remarkably different way of looking at life. But that's how James says you need to view this. Isn't that amazing how he puts that? All right, Justin. That's a great point. What are wealthy people? I mean, people wealthy in this world's goods. What are they always so worried about? Well, yeah. But what are all of us? We want to keep what we've got. Don't want to lose it. You know? Whether it's Obama or Romney or whoever. Somebody, you know. Help us here. So we don't, you know, we're so worried about not losing it. And of course, what James says is, you're going to lose anything. So, you know, that's not even the issue. But yeah, we tend to so view it the other way, Isaac. Yeah, that's true. Though it's interesting, what point did Jesus make about a rich man and whether it's easy for a rich man to enter the kingdom? That's right. He says it's hard to get a camel to go through the eye of a needle. And by the way, I think he's not meaning, as some people have said for years, there's no truth to it, that there was some gate in Jerusalem that only a camel had to bend down. That's not true. I don't know where that got started, but that's a false point. He's talking about a real needle. I mean, it really is. Just, you know, come on, camel. Come on. All right, go on through. You know, well, I mean, how do you do that? But that's kind of how Jesus puts it, as if it's an impossibility. And, of course, then when his disciples responded, well, then how can anybody be saved? And, of course, Jesus said, well, by the grace of God, a lot of amazing things. So it's possible through God's grace, but not through a rich man's own efforts. That's the point. But you're right. You know what James says here, though, certainly does give hope to a rich man who understands his humiliation and he's losing all this. It's just temporary. As long as he understands that and is living his life with that recognition, then you know he's in good stead. Scott.
Yeah. And as far as if this is addressed to a brother that has wealth,
Yeah.
Via the first line.
Sure.
And so, generally speaking, a brother that has wealth is going to look around and try and help some people that actually need some help.
Well, yeah, I mean, you would hope so, and that's what he needs to do. But James is focusing in upon, okay, what should that rich follower of Jesus, how should he view his wealth? Yeah. And, of course, one other thing, too, I think to kind of keep in mind, just to appreciate this statement in its Jewish context, given the concept of the kingdom that Jews prior to the time of Jesus always had, that it's a physical, material, political kind of kingdom. Okay, if that's the kind of kingdom, okay, think about politics, even in our day, in our society. Who has a foot in the door in the political realm? Who has the politician's ear? Who maybe can get invited to the White House? The poor person or the wealthy person? Okay, the rich man, the wealthy person. So, this is what, you know, Jews who were anticipating the Messiah who was coming, and they're thinking totally in a geopolitical kind of kingdom sense. Well, the rich Jews kind of felt like they had a free shot in the door there, you know. And so this, again, is why what James says here is such a powerful, iconoclastic teaching, because it just overturns everything that you would normally think of in regard to wealth and a kingdom, the kingdoms of men at least. Okay, other comments about this little section of verses? All right. He then seemingly shifts gears somewhat abruptly, but again, we can kind of argue as to maybe a connection here between these various things. But at least in some sense, he now moves on to a different topic. Blessed is a man, verse 12, who perseveres under trial. For once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, I'm being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. Then when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. All right, let's look at the first part of this. James kind of goes back to this subject he had first introduced in verse 2. He talks about the blessing of a man who perseveres under his time of trial. For once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life. Let's just talk about that image. In fact, I think so much of James, by the way, just a little tip as you are reading through it. Like any good writer, the imagery, and understand the imagery, is all important. So don't gloss over some of the images, like the flowering field that fades, or here, the crown of life. What's he talking about when he talks about the crown of life in their culture? What was that referring to? The Greek word crown is the word Stephanos. We get our name Stephen from it, but it's the Greek word Stephanos, and that was talking about the victor's crown. And of course, athletic games were very much a part of Greco-Roman and Jewish culture, because the Jewish people were part of the Greco-Roman world. And victor's crown, when you would be successful at the Isthmian Games near Corinth, or the Olympic Games in the Greek city of Olympia, then the victor's crown might be this kind of, sometimes, rarely, but sometimes this kind of metal crown that you would wear. Not a crown designating royalty, but a crown designating your victoriousness at the games. And so it sometimes might be a metal crown like that. More often, it was a wreath made of garlands or various vegetables or plants that would form a wreath, and that was a symbol of you as the victor. And this was a very, very big deal. This, by the way, is a votive stele, like a monument to the various victors of the Isthmian Games, just a couple of miles from Corinth. Remember the athletic imagery that Paul refers to in his letters to the Corinthians? Well, it's because that was very much a part of their culture. Every 2 years, you'd have the Isthmian Games. And so this is just a monument that is commemorating all of the victors in the various contests, whether they be athletic contests or horse riding, equestrian type events, or poetry events. You know, the Greeks were a lot more well-rounded than maybe we are. You know, I mean, our idea of a dumb jock who's real good at sports but is unintelligent, that would have been just repugnant to the Greek mind. So, you know, a well-rounded person was a person who was a great athlete, but also mentally he was sharp and was educated and spoke poetry and all that kind of thing. So they had contests for all of that. And so all that's just depicted here. And let me just show you this. How important was winning? I think this does relate to James' use of the imagery. How important was it to win? How important is it to an athlete in our day to win the Olympic Games? Pretty big deal, right? I mean, that's pretty major, you know. Only comes every 4 years, and that's a big deal. Okay, here's an inscription found at Megara, a little city in Greece, in reference to an athlete who performed at Olympia, the original town where we get the Olympic Games, the heritage of the Olympic Games from. Here's the epitaph on his grave. Here he died, boxing in the stadium, having prayed to Zeus for either the crown or death, age 35. Farewell. Well, I mean, I think you can kind of get the implication in all that. Let's just say he came in second place. But that was not an unheard of thing. Now, I don't mean that every Olympic game they would have, or Isthmian games, the other kinds of games they would have various times around Greece. I don't mean by that, you know, just people dying, that was just kind of, you know, normal and natural and everything. No, but it wasn't rare either. It wasn't just unheard of. And so the idea of a boxer actually dying, you know, I mean, we even have had some instances of that in our modern day. But this was absolutely, it was it. I mean, you know, if I die, I die, but I'm going to win this Stephanus, this crown. That's what a big deal it was. And James says, okay, think of it like that, but there's a greater crown, a more important wreath that you're striving for. Blessed is a man who perseveres under trial. For once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. And of course, the underlying implication in all that imagery is for an athlete or a contestant in any of these games in the Greco-Roman world, for them to win, do they have to undergo tremendous trial to do so? Is it laborious work? Is it tough? Is it difficult? Is it strenuous? Absolutely. And as we just saw, I mean, that is like my whole life, sometimes even literally, that's how important this event is. That's how that was viewed. And so he says, that's the way it's going to be for us following Jesus. It is going to be a time of trial and difficulty and persecution where we have to persevere. Just like that, say, the marathon runner who's having to endure the end of that race. But once we've gone through that and we receive the victor's wreath, then they make everything worthwhile. No athlete who wins at even our modern Olympic Games, no athlete who wins regrets afterward having put in all that work and struggle. It's all worth it. And that's what James is saying, that this is a crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. So it's really a powerful image. Comments about what he's saying there in verse 12. Isaac?
Well, you know, we keep talking about batting the time, you know,
And in fact, I'll just say this, that in my sermon this evening, I plan to talk a little bit more about how James the man, in the latter part of his life, had to live up to the very words that he was preaching here. We'll talk about that this evening. It's sort of a commercial for tonight's lesson. So, but yeah, I agree with what you're saying. Very good. I think you're right, and I think as you look at these seemingly disparate topics that James talks about, you really begin to see, no, they really all do tie in. Okay, who else? Did we overlook somebody? Yes, Pat.
I just wanted to make a quick point.
Sure.
It's amazing the similarity between, like you said, the Olympics and the spiritual side of what he's talking about. You know, when you get first place in the Olympics, the guy coming in second, third, and fourth, in their mind must be, if I just trained a little bit harder,
yeah,
if I just done a little bit more.
Yeah, what if? If only I had served the Lord, yeah, changed my life, but I didn't. Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. Okay, anybody? Yeah, Debbie. Very true. Very true. Helen?
Just have a quick observation. The wording of this reminds me of the end.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I'm glad that you said that. For the benefit of those who couldn't hear her, Helen was just coming, that the way this is worded, blessed is a man who perseveres. It reminds you of the Beatitudes that Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5. I'm glad you said that for this reason. I don't think I have actually made this point, and I should have. As you go through the letter that James writes, there's a lot of things that just allude to or call to mind sermons of Jesus, statements that Jesus made. There's a lot of Old Testament imagery, like that whole flower that fades and grass in the field. I mean, that just reminds you of Isaiah 40. But there's a lot of things that he says that you can just tell that the teaching of Jesus, even though James was not one of the band of disciples, he's learned it now, and it's just part of his vernacular. It's just the way that he thinks and the way that he talks. And that's the way it is, I think, with all of us as disciples of Jesus. The words of Scripture really do. That becomes our vernacular, and that's the way it ought to be. So I think you see that several places here in James. Okay. Now, really, I think still in the same vein, he then says, verse 13, let no one say when he is tempted, and by the way, the word tempted, as I talked about the other day, translated in English, tempted, that's the same Greek word, perismos, that previously is the word trial or tried. So it's from that same word. So let no one say when he is tempted, and whether he means by that tempted to commit sin, or whether he means that more generically, tried, Okay. He says, let no one say when undergoing that kind of circumstance, I am being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. And this is, of course, a classic example where you have to put statements in their context, because there are other passages that Genesis 22, that in fact in the Septuagint, the same wording, same terminology. God tempted Abraham. God tried Abraham when he commanded him to go sacrifice his son Isaac. But what does James mean when he says, don't say I'm being tempted or I'm being tried by God? In the context in which he's saying this, what does he mean? Okay. In other words, he's saying God is not the one who's in the role of Satan trying to get me to do evil. Okay? And if we understand that, that'll maybe help us answer this next question. As he's explaining why no one should say, I'm being tempted by God, he makes this argument for God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. Well, I think we can understand why he makes the second point. God does not tempt anyone with evil. God's not trying to get anybody to do evil. He's not dangling a carrot in front of your nose just trying to get you to sin. So we can understand that, why he says that second statement, the last statement of verse 13. But why does he say the previous statement? What's the logical connection? For God cannot be tempted by evil. What's that got to do with it? You see the question I'm asking?
God is over everything. He has control over everything. He's not going to be tempted by that, which is something that he has control over.
And what is the fact that God cannot be tempted by evil? What's that got to do with the issue of, therefore we know God would not tempt us to do? Okay, because that would be an evil, malicious kind of motive. The person trying to tempt somebody else to do wrong, trying to get them, to entice them to sin, that would only be an evil person who himself has been tempted with evil and malice and wickedness. And so that's what James is saying. In every aspect of that, that's something that God has no part at all. God cannot be tempted by evil. God is so far above sin that evil and malice and wickedness and all that is never something that he would even be tempted to do, much less actually do it. So that's the logical connection with all that. So don't ever think when you're going through this time of trial, and by the way, don't people so often think this? Well, they start blaming God, and God hates me, or God's malicious, or God's wicked, and God's trying to... Okay. That's not what God does. Now, as we've just recently seen in our study of the book of Job last quarter, does God allow people to go through trials and to have their faith put to the test? Yes, and in fact, James had just talked about that back in chapter 1, verse 2. But the point is, God is not trying to get someone to sin. He's not just some evil being like with Job. He wasn't just toying with Job. And Job's my little plaything. I'm just going to make things rough for him. You know, he's not some little kid, you know, trying to be mean to the pets, you know, or something. That's not God. And so what James says is when you're going through that time of trial, or when you're being tempted then to maybe sin, don't blame God as if God is somehow trying to entice you to commit sin. That's not what is going on. And then I'm going to talk about what he goes on to say, each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. The real thing about it that is producing this temptation for you to do evil, it's not God as an outside force, it's actually coming from within you. The problem is your own lust and your own desire. That's the real problem that you need to address. Let me quickly address this because I think it's interesting. James uses sort of a Jewish manner of speaking about things here. And I think this is helpful. There's a lot of Jewish writings, rabbinic writings, but I think even in the Dead Sea Scrolls you sort of have the inkling of the same kind of thing. Jewish manner of speaking. The rabbinic writings talk about the Yetzer Hara, the evil impulse, the evil inclination. That's what they would use to describe what we call temptation to do sin. It's as if there's just some evil something in us that just compels us to then go do sinful things. And that comes from within us. And what's interesting about this is that when you look at the Jewish writings, they do with it exactly what James does. That whole idea of the inclination to do evil, they liken it to sexual desire. Because that's such an apt analogy. Because the sexual impulse, the sexual drive is so powerful, and the people sometimes just do just ridiculous things all because of that. And so the Jewish writings oftentimes liken it to the idea of sexual desire. That's exactly what James does. He says, each one is tempted when he is drawn away and enticed by his own lust. And then he says, when lust has conceived, there's your sexual imagery. When lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And then he says, when sin is accomplished, and I think the imagery there is okay, that sexual lust or sexual type. Lust for that which is sinful, whatever the sin is, and then you are compelled by that, and then you give in to that, and you satisfy that lust for what is, in this case, sinful and wrong, and what happens? There's a child that is produced. It's the child of sin that now you have sired. But it doesn't stop there. That child of sin that you've sired, he says, when it is accomplished, or some versions say when it's fully grown, it brings forth death. In other words, you're giving in to this desire, this evil impulse to do that which is wrong, and you satisfy that lust that you have. It produces sin that comes back and then murders you. That's the image. I mean, just think about that imagery. Siring a child that then commits patricide. But that's what sin is. And he says that all starts with your desire. With your desire for that which is wrong, and yet you want to satisfy that at all costs. But it ultimately will come back to be your own undoing, your own demise. So it is a really, really powerful image that James uses there. And he says, now don't be blaming God for this. The real root problem is your own desire, your own lust. That's what you've got to quell. Make some sense? Sorry we had to kind of rush that a bit there. But if you want to talk about that further Wednesday night before we go on, we can certainly do that. All right, thank you, folks.